This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for December 16th, 2013. We found seven items of interest last week, beginning with regulations on the deductibility of startup and organizational expenses for partnerships that undergo a technical termination. Then, IRS guidance on the 2014 standard mileage rates, which were widely advertised, of course, widely reported in the news. Payments to a veterinarian are not exempt from information reporting because they are payments for health care. We'll talk about who is responsible for generating a Form 1099 to a veterinarian and under what circumstances. And then an award of attorney fees to a couple that prevailed in a tax dispute with the Internal Revenue Service, but not after a very long and I'm sure debilitating fight. Then a manufacturer using improper accounting method for advance payments, not when they started, but after they changed the way they did business, their accounting method became an improper method. An opinion of the Fifth Circuit in DFS Systems, concluding that a corporation that, perhaps out of the kindness of the owner's heart, advanced money to the family of an employee, long-term employee who had become ill, and then attempted to write that off as a bad debt. And finally, the Pilgrim's Pride decision, in which the tax court found that the surrender of securities resulted in a capital loss, much to the surprise of many commentators in the tax commenting community. So, with that as prelude, let's get started and let's talk about proposed regulation providing guidance on the deductibility of startup expenditures and organization costs when a partnership undergoes a technical termination. The citation is REG-126285-12, and of course that's found in the citations document, a Word document that accompanies this MP3 document and should be immediately available from the same source that you are acquiring the audio. It seems some taxpayers are taking or have been taking the position that a technical termination under Section 708B1B entitles a partnership to deduct unamortized startup expenses and organization costs to the extent provided in Code Section 165. That result, however, according to the Internal Revenue Service, is contrary to the congressional intent underlying Sections 195, 708, and 709. The legislative purpose of Section 195 and 709 was to allow expenses incurred in the formation of a partnership to be deducted ratably over the period that the partnership benefits from those initial expenses. Now, the technical termination of a partnership presents us with some unique issues, and not everything that happens in connection with the technical termination is intuitive. These regulations require that the original amortization period for startup costs and organization expenses be maintained even after the partnership goes through a technical termination. But as you know, other issues in a technical termination, for example, the basis of our depreciable assets or the depreciable period for depreciable assets, we start over following a technical termination. And so the rules are inconsistent. There is no logical arrangement of the rules here on which we can rely. The proposed regs amend Regulation Section 1.708-1 and provide as follows, that a new partnership formed because of a transaction or a series of transactions described in Section 708B1B must continue amortizing the Section 195 and Section 709 expenses using the same amortization period adopted by the terminating partnership. These regulations, when they are finalized, by the way, will apply to technical terminations occurring after December 8, 2013. Next, we have the standard mileage rates for 2014, a drop of 0.5 cents. So the standard mileage rate for business use of an automobile will be 56 cents. The standard rate for charitable use is 14 cents. The charitable rate for medical and moving expenses is 23.5 cents. And remember that 22 cents of that 56 cents is deemed to be depreciation, so that if you roll enough miles at 22 cents a mile, arguably you have zero basis remaining. You can exhaust your basis in the automobile, and that is, of course, important when you try to determine the gain or loss on the disposition of the automobile. A lot of people miss that they use the standard mileage rate for year after year, whatever, and then they forget that the deemed depreciation of 22 cents per mile will reduce the basis of the vehicle upon sale or trade. Citation on that, by the way, is Notice 2013-80. Then, in Internal Legal Memorandum 2013-49-013, the IRS rules that payments made in the course of a taxpayer's trade or business to a veterinarian, even if the veterinarian is incorporated, must be reported to the Internal Revenue Service under Section 6041 if those payments exceed $600 during the year. Payments exceeding $600 annually to veterinarians for veterinary services for animals that are used in the taxpayer's trade or business are subject to the reporting because the veterinarian is engaged in providing medical and health care services. Now, there are some exceptions to the 1099 reporting in Section 6041, but this is not one of them. Corporations which are engaged in providing medical and health care services are not exempt from the reporting requirement. So the term medical or health care services is not restricted to health care services performed on humans. And so veterinarian services fall within the scope of medical and health care services. And there is not any exclusion under Section 6041 which would allow a business that is using the services of a veterinarian, even if the veterinarian is incorporated, to avoid the requirement to provide the veterinarian with a Form 1099 if payments to the veterinarian or the incorporated veterinarian during the year exceed $600. John Perciello and his wife prevailed in a tax dispute with the Internal Revenue Service and have been awarded attorney's fees, a decision by the United States District Court in the District of New Jersey. Mr. Perciello is a licensed engineer, worked for several businesses. The business that he was working for when this trouble started was an engineering company, and his duties were exclusively sales-related. The folks that were running the business didn't pay the payroll taxes, and the IRS came after Mr. Perciello for a liability in excess of $50,000. To help you get this dispute in perspective, the payroll taxes which were not withheld were for March 1998 and June 1998. Here's the rest of the story. On February 2nd, 2002, the Perciellos, who had filed a timely original income tax return for the fiscal year 2000, filed an amended return claiming a refund of $58,930. When they didn't hear from the IRS regarding the status of the 2000 return, they contacted the IRS numerous times. They wrote letters, they made phone calls, but failed to receive any information. On December 23rd, 2002, 11 months after the Perciellos had filed the amended return, an IRS employee from the Taxpayer Advocate Office wrote to the Perciellos advising they were due a refund, not of $58,000, but of $41,000, but that sum was being applied to civil penalties from the year 1998. Now, we're 4 years into this, right? April 3rd, 2002, the IRS assessed Mr. Perciello with trust fund recovery penalties for the first and second quarters of 1998. Over the next few years, the Perciellos and the IRS go back and forth trying to resolve the tax disputes that involved both the 1998 withholding penalties as well as an injured spouse claim filed by Mrs. Perciello. 9 years later, on July 7th, 2011, Mr. and Mrs. Perciello sued the Internal Revenue Service for their refund. The issue of Mrs. Perciello's injured spouse claim had been resolved. So the only requirements that were addressed were those of Mr. Perciello's recovery of his tax refund. Now, this is 9 years later. I want to keep this in perspective, okay? On January 28, 2013, the court finally ruled on the July 7th, 2011 original filing. So we're, a year and a half later, the court finally gets around to summary judgment for the plaintiffs. And the court here ruled that Mr. Perciello had in fact made an informal claim prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations. And it appears, by the way, as I read the record of this, it appears to me that the IRS jiggled Mr. Percielo around, not advising him that even there was a statute of limitations. And then when he finally sued him, they came into court and said, oh, well, he missed the statute of limitations. The judge was having none of that. And the court ruled that the IRS was estopped from arguing that the plaintiffs were not entitled to the refund because they had somehow already accepted the merits of because the IRS had already accepted the merits of the Percielo's position. The instant matter now, based on all of that, based on a 9-year history of back and forth with an intransigent IRS, deceptive, deceitful, and uncooperative, we finally get around to discussing whether or not the IRS is going to pay the winning party's legal fees. This is a 4-element discussion, and the elements are these. Number one, the taxpayer must be the prevailing party. There's no question in the court's mind that in this case, Mr. and Mrs. Percielo are the prevailing parties. Number two, is the award for reasonable administrative and litigation costs? Mr. Percielo seeks $45,751 in attorney's fees. The court gave him $45,553. So obviously, they believed his request was reasonable. The other two elements, the third, that the plaintiff has exhausted available administrative remedies, and four, has not unreasonably protracted administrative or judicial proceedings, the IRS conceded. The only unreasonable protraction of the proceedings was by the Internal Revenue Service. So the only two required elements that were in dispute were whether or not the plaintiffs were the prevailing party and whether or not the award was reasonable, and the court ruled in favor of the Percielos on both counts. What's important for us as practitioners is to know what those four required elements are before we can recover attorney's fees and make sure we keep really good records of what we do, when we do it, and why we do it, so that we can present our case where seeking fees where the IRS has run us through the jumps unreasonably. Next, we have a field attorney advisory, 2013-48-01F, in which the IRS addresses a situation where a manufacturer is using an improper accounting method for advance payments. Now, it didn't start out that way. When the advance payment program was established, the way in which the manufacturer did business and the way in which the customers took merchandise was appropriately addressed by the exception in Regulation Section 1.451-5 to the Accrual Accounting Methods All Events Test. The payments were received as advance payments for goods to be provided under long-term contracts. But after initially establishing the accounting method, and this is something we all need to be alert for, and that is the client whose business changes and as a result should change their accounting method but does not do so. And so we have clients whose accounting methods, which were good accounting methods, they were proper methods when they started out, become improper methods because of a change in the client's business practices or business policies, and that's what happened here. The taxpayer's liability under the original contracts was otherwise ended, and that phrase is in quotes, otherwise ended within the meaning of Regulation Section 1.451-5F, which required the manufacturer to immediately recognize as deferred revenue all the deferred revenue attributable to those contracts. Further, even if the manufacturer's liability under the contracts didn't end, the manufacturer's failure to recognize any initial advance payments when it sold the goods violates Regulation 1.451-5B, which allows a taxpayer to defer recognizing advance payments to when it would otherwise recognize income under its method of accounting. So the manufacturer's method of deferring the advance payments became improper, along with its apparent change to that method without obtaining the required consent under Code Section 446E. So the manufacturer may no longer use the advance payment method of accounting because amendments made to its contracts make it impossible to determine the average contract price of the items, making Regulation Section 1.451-5 inapplicable. Further, the IRS comments, frequent contract changes, which were no doubt necessary as business decisions, make it impossible to test whether the inventoryable goods exception in Regulation Section 1.451-5C applies. So once again, it's really important when our clients change their business practices or change their methods or alter contracts, we need to revisit the accounting methods that are related to those transactions to assure that we still have a permissible accounting method. Next, we have a decision from the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit regarding DFS systems. This is an unpublished opinion in which the Fifth Circuit agrees with the tax court that purported loans for which the corporation claimed bad debt deductions were not bona fide loans. Here are the facts. The corporation wrote 19 checks totaling $25,320 to Jose Padilla, a longtime employee who was forced to stop working due to a terminal illness, and three other checks to Ruben Padilla, Mr. Padilla's son. At the time, DF Systems recognized these payments at a special board meeting, but no indication that the checks were intended to be a loan. They were just going to provide Mr. Padilla with the funds to get him through his long-term illness. About the same time, the DF Systems organized another corporation headed by the owner of DF Systems' daughter to bid on minority contracts, and they advanced a total of $56,656 to that corporation, which was, although not technically related, I mean, the Internal Revenue Code would not call a corporation owned by my adult child as a related corporation under the brother-sister rules, but the advances to that corporation totaled $56,656, and they were not documented either. On their 2006, and this all happened in 2005, on the 2006 federal income tax return, DF Systems claimed a bad debt deduction of $56,656 for the advances to EL Construction, which was a company owned by the DF Systems owner's daughter, and $25,320 relating to payments to the Padillas. The IRS audits the return. Obviously, you throw $80,000 of bad debt deductions in a tax return, the IRS is going to have some interest in that return. The IRS determined that these amounts were not bad debts arising from true debtor-creditor relationships. They were not based upon valid and legally enforceable obligations. There is no indication that those amounts actually became worthless during the taxable year, and it does not appear that you took all reasonable steps to collect the debts. So DF Systems has a tax deficiency in the amount of $30,728. The IRS does not go through all of the various factors that might be considered in determining whether we have a bona fide debt, but simply concludes its field attorney advice with this paragraph. In evaluating whether a debt is bona fide, we, quote, look not to mere labels or to the self-serving declarations of the parties, but to the more reliable criteria of the circumstances surrounding the transaction. And they cite for that quote, Tyler versus Tomlinson, 414 Federal 2nd 844, a decision of the Fifth Circuit back in 1969. So I think I said that was a field attorney advisory. It was a Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. Sorry, I do occasionally get confused. But we all do, right? Finally, Pilgrim's Pride Corporation, a full tax court decision, 141 TC number 17, which I'm sure came as a surprise to people who really thought they knew the tax law. The tax court has agreed with the Internal Revenue Service that a $98.6 million ordinary loss claimed by Pilgrim's Pride as the result of its surrender of certain securities was a capital loss, subject to the loss limitations of Sections 1211 and 1212. According to the IRS and the tax court, the surrender is a deemed sale or exchange of capital assets, and the authority for that is Code Section 1234A. Here are the facts. Pilgrim's Pride is a successor in interest to Goldkist. Goldkist had purchased securities from Southern States Cooperative to the tune of about $98.6 million back in 1999. In 2004, 5 years later, when Southern States was in financial difficulty, they offered to redeem the securities for $20 million, which would have stuck Pilgrim's Pride with a $78 million capital loss. Now, capital losses don't do corporations very much good because they can only be offset by capital gains. So the offer was rejected. the taxpayer determined they would obtain a greater tax savings by simply surrendering the securities and claiming an ordinary loss, which they did. Surrendered the securities in 2004 and claimed a $98.6 million ordinary loss. In Howard Dawson's opinion, and he's the judge that wrote the opinion here, the taxpayer was not entitled to claim an ordinary loss for the surrender of the securities. In a what is a trailblazing opinion, this is the first time 1234A has been applied to the surrender of securities. And what the judge found was that a right or obligation, and that's the term that's used in the statute, Code Section 1234A refers to the surrendering of a right or obligation. It doesn't take you all the way to a surrender of full ownership of the securities. But Judge Dawson says that a loss from some terminations is deemed a loss from the sale of capital assets. The parties agreed that the securities were capital assets in the hands of the taxpayer. So the IRS and the taxpayer agree these are capital assets. What they disagree about is the applicability of Section 1234A. The IRS believes that the surrender of the securities terminated all of the taxpayer's rights regarding those capital assets, triggering Section 1234A and treatment of the resulting loss as a loss from the sale or exchange of property. The taxpayer argues, as I would have argued based on just a reading of the statute, that Section 1234 Cap A only applies to a contractual or other derivative right to property and not property rights inherent in the ownership of the property. This is a full tax court decision. It's really important for the understanding of Code Section 1234 Cap A, which I think most of us have believed only related to derivatives and puts and calls and derivatives, but it doesn't. It relates, according to Judge Dawson, and unless his opinion is overturned on appeal, it relates to full ownership of the property as well. Thanks for joining me this week. And let me share our usual advice with you. Stay safe.